Hey, welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That is 5 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes. That's 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador. But for those who say our recitation of the time zones is just totally boring, we have something different for you today, because there is at present only 4 hours between our home base in North American Eastern Time and the Greenwich Meridian. Normally on this show, it's 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time, 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. But right now it is actually 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. It's 4 hours ahead in London because we've sprung into summer and they're still all fallen back in winter. So greetings to our listeners in the British Isles and in Western Europe, where it's 9 p.m. in Paris and Berlin, 10 p.m. in Cairo and Jerusalem, 11 p.m. in Istanbul and Moscow, and the early hours of Friday morning for our Asian and Pacific listeners. But wherever you are, welcome along to our Clubland Q&A. This is how it works. You can listen anywhere in the world, whether or not you're a member of the Mark Steyn Club. You do have to be a club member to ask a question. If you whip out the old debit card super quickly, you could join right now and shoot me a question. We always like to welcome new members, but if you're not in the least bit interested, it doesn't matter. You don't have to be a club member just to listen to the show. I should say, before we go any further, that if you hear a few technical glitches, such as the one right at the beginning, where immediately after our signature tune there was a sudden unexpected blast of music, that's because our longtime audio engineer, Joe, has been taken rather poorly, rather ill, and is undergoing a pretty crummy bout of health issues at the moment. So we're struggling through as best we can. But if the show sounds even more totally inept and incompetent and amateurish than usual, it is because Joe is not here. Also, I want to mention that tonight I will be making a rare Thursday appearance on Tucker's show. That is at 8 p.m. U.S. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. that's midnight Greenwich Mean Time, and usually a laugh. I might do a whole other recitation of time zones here. I believe what we'll be talking about is that Joe Biden excuse of a press conference that ended just about an hour ago. so I think I'll save whatever thoughts I can muster for that pitiful performance until I'm with Tucker in a few hours' time. So instead, let's get to your questions. Michelle Dulac says, what do you anticipate Joe Biden doing in the very likely now event of a People's Republic of China attack on Taiwan? I presume that he will not literally sit there with his thumb in his mouth, but will he mount the sort of defense that would make a difference? Because, I mean, that would be dangerous. Taiwan cannot physically defend itself against the PRC if they really want to take the quote-unquote province back. But we could. This all arises, I think, from the Chinese Communist Party's 100th birthday this June. That's actually quite impressive. For a Communist Party to still be in power, as you know, that is not the situation that prevails in the Soviet Union and in most of the rest of the communist world, where even those countries, those ruling communist parties didn't live to celebrate their 100th birthday. So that's something of which the Chaicoms can be proud. I mean, basically, the only reason they're still around and they haven't gone the way of the rest of the communist world is because the geniuses of the Chamber of Commerce, right, decided to help Chairman Xi and his comrades in coming up with the only economically viable form of communism. So thank you, fiscal conservatives, for coming up with the genius idea of transferring the American economy to China. Thank you for that. And they are going to, nevertheless, having made it to their 100th birthday, they're going to want to give themselves a 100th birthday present. And the perfect 100th birthday present would be Taiwan. Even if they don't go for it, they're going to want to unnerve America by making them think they're going to go for it. The question is whether, really, whether they could find a way to go for it that would oblige America not to respond. You know, for example, I think about Hong Kong, where pretty much the Sino-British Treaty on Hong Kong is dead. They basically decided they can't be bothered and they'd like Hong Kong to be just another part of China. And they got away with it in part because of the COVID. And the COVID provided sufficient cover. You didn't need a lot of cover because, well, put it this way. The cover enabled Boris Johnson to do what he probably would have done anyway, which is to do nothing. But having the COVID meant that people didn't notice that he did nothing. So the question here is, what China can do without anybody noticing. Because we all know that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and all the rest of them don't want to have to go to war over Taiwan. The preferred kind of war for America in the 21st century is against goat herds with fertilizer that just chunter along for 20 years, actually 20 decades, maybe closer to it by the time we're all through, 20 years. And in a sense, winning or losing doesn't really matter because it's not against the consequential power. So they don't want to have to go to war with China, A, because, you know, be honest, we all know how it's likely to go. And B, it's not the kind of war that they and the military-industrial complex are interested. You know, if you're like the current defense secretary of the United States, I can't remember his name, I'm like Joe Biden in that respect, but whoever the guy is, he was formerly a lobbyist for Raytheon. And there is a military-industrial complex, and some things like Afghanistan are useful because nobody really cares about them. It's not really on the news very much unless an IED explodes and kills more than a handful of Western troops. Other than that, it doesn't even make the news, and it's a great place to test out all your new weaponry and all the rest of it. And that's the kind of wars that suit the military-industrial complex. They don't want to have to go to war with China because that's not likely to go well. But so the trick for the Politburo would be to figure out a way to bend Taiwan to its will while providing Joe Biden with an excuse for doing nothing about it. But as Michelle points out, Taiwan cannot physically defend itself against the PRC. And she says that a war, quote, would be dangerous. It would be dangerous for us. Right now, China's succeeded in taking over the world without firing a shot, at least at us. And I do think, to a certain extent, they would like to keep it that way. But Taiwan is the perfect birthday present. Mark says Kelly Senior of Milwaukee, Kelly Ambrose Senior of Milwaukee. Mark, how would you compare the view of America presented by China's Yang Zhejiang at the recent Anchorage conference? This is the guy who sat and listened to Antony Blinken and after 2 minutes told him to take a hike and go pound sand. How would you compare his view at the recent Anchorage conference to the view of, say, the presidents of Harvard, Yale and Princeton, or Nancy Pelosi, or a typical American fifth grade teacher, or your neighbor with the virtue signal yard signs? This is the guy who accused America of committing genocide against African Americans. When Khrushchev, says Kelly Ambrose Sr., Khrushchev tough-talked Kennedy in the 60s. This is when he was pounding his shoe on the table. What he was saying about America was viewed as communist blather spoken by an enemy. Today, an enemy expresses the same view as we hear from the government and its media every day. Yup. Bingo, as Peter Navarro likes to say, Kelly. Bingo, bingo, bingo. One of our problems, and this goes back to where we came in with in this new century in 9/11, is that, as you say, the critical levers of society, in many respects, more critical than your military strength, which is your ideological strength, and of course, all the ideological heights of our society are held by enemies of this society, people who agree with that Chinese fellow's critique of the United States that America's committing genocide against African Americans and all the rest of it. It's one of the reasons, I think, that we, you know, that Iraq didn't go the way it could have gone. I've made this point, I think this was in After America, it might have been in some other book, but I made it at some length, that essentially the British Empire exported itself through education, a very light military footprint, but a lot of school teachers out in dusty bits of the desert or on palm-fronded islands, and those teachers... The principal element in the toolkit was to give the natives the same education as somebody in England would get. That was Lord Macaulay's famous minute on Indian education, which I think is the reason now. That's basically the reason why every time you call tech support, you're getting Rajiv or Suresh in Bangalore solving your tech query, is because of Lord Macaulay's paper on Indian education. And as I said, a very basic principle that you're doing people a favour when you're teaching them Greek and Latin and Shakespeare and Bach and Haydn and all the rest of it, that you're doing them a favour, giving them the same education you would give some kid in England. Our problem in Iraq was that, and Don Rumsfeld explained this to me at some length, that that each department in the United States government was responsible for its equivalent department in Iraq. So after Saddam fell, the U.S. Treasury was responsible for the Iraqi Treasury, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture was responsible for Iraqi agriculture, and the U.S. Department of Education was responsible for Iraqi education. So the first thing any Iraqi school kid, any Iraqi grade 3 school kid sitting there listening to what he's getting from the U.S. Department of Education is thinking, stone me, these guys hate America even more than Saddam did. And actually, that is why we are ineffectual. That is why we are ineffectual. And Kelly Sr. from Milwaukee is quite keen, is quite correct to point that out. We simply do not have... the ideological will to maintain our position in the world. That's also basically why the British Empire came to a close, and why you now have idiots like Prince Harry attacking what was a great force for good in the world. It's a very difficult road back once... the heights of your society are commanded by self-loathers, which is the situation here. Robert Bridges says, talk about going back to the good old days. Let's go back to before Clinton to the 60s and retrieve a classic Maoist phrase, paper tiger. With the US bogged down in Vietnam, trying to win a never-ending war the hard way, sound familiar? Mao coined the phrase. Well, here we are in 2021, and it fits. Never-ending wars, the US is reduced to bending over and getting a twirl from the mercantile Maoists. China is in it for keeps, And the Biden administration wants a participation award. Yeah, this thing I was talking about with Tucker, whenever it was last night, about the so-called summit between Kamala Harris and Bill Clinton about the challenges of COVID for women and girls is actually a classic example of why we're a paper tiger and a total joke. Because, as I mentioned to Tucker, it's not an issue. Men are far more afflicted by COVID than women are. Generally, it's a good basic rule that if when it comes to who COVID's going to get, it helps to start if you're a woman. And yet everyone. So here we have two people, two supposedly important, prominent, powerful people talking about a non-issue, and yet nobody is going to say it's a non-issue. When they report this story in their usual drooling, sycophantic way, the court eunuchs of the American media are going to pretend that it is something consequential. And that stupid little one-on-one, not a phrase anyone should use lightly when Bill Clinton's one of the ones who's going to be on the other one, that one-on-one is actually a perfect encapsulation of what a bunch of crapped-out losers we are. By we, I mean Western civilization in general. But as the quote-unquote leader of the free world, if it is still the free world, more of this falls on America's leadership than perhaps Americans might wish. But this joke summit for a non-issue. How many times do we actually have a real summit for a real issue? How often does that happen? How often does that happen? Paper Tiger is putting it politely. You'll remember the apocryphal Japanese I fear we have awakened a sleeping giant. It's actually very hard to wake America up. You know, for a few moments in the spring, people were like a little bit woked up to what was going on with China and how if we don't get our act together, the jig's up. And then the sleeping giant went back to sleep again. And so the important issue is Kamala and the Sultan of Swing talking about how COVID afflicts women and girls. What a pathetic... The paper tiger is flattering such a creature. Owlman from CA writes, "Hi, Mark, what is the thinking?" I think that's California rather than the Dominion of Canada, as I recall. Owlman says, "Hi, Mark, what is the thinking behind giving time or especially money to the Clintons or their foundation at this time in history? What could they possibly promise to an individual or country as a return on investment? Maybe when Kamala meets with Bill, they could have Harvey Weinstein call in via Zoom, since the other guy from Pedo Island who was in prison isn't currently available." You seem terribly confident that Jeffrey Epstein is actually dead. There, Al, I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't zooming into this conference on empowering women and girls. He's got a few vacancies for stewardesses on the Lolita Express, I understand. I think this would make sense if we had a conventional government headed by a conventional chief executive. But we don't. Nobody really knows who's running what purports to be the United States government at the moment. Nobody does. And it certainly isn't the guy who presents himself as its chief magistrate. It certainly isn't Kamala. It could just be that the deep state have finally figured out that this is the perfect solution. You don't actually need anyone in the Oval Office. You can do it with a dead husk. It doesn't matter. So if you take that position, then you look at the people who are the permanent players, the permanent actors, and the Clintons are representing themselves. The Clinton Foundation went away after Hillary lost. Because if you recall, after November whatever it was, November the 5th or whatever, 2016. They had, the Clinton Foundation had a massive final weekend, closing down everything price to clear, massive store-wide clearances. And the price for a Chelsea Clinton speech about diarrhea in Africa dropped from $2 million to about $1.73. And no one was interested because people understood that that Hillary was on the outs, wasn't connected with anyone. Then what happened is the deep state obstructed the presidency, obstructed the man who won the presidency. And so we're now in this weird world where we don't actually know whether it's Susan Rice or Barack Obama or whoever it is who's controlling the government of the United States. But in such a world, it's very plausible. You say, well, what have the Clintons got to offer? Well, if you're just, you know, a Sudanese warlord, you're a Kazakh oligarch, and you've got some spare cash lying around, the Clintons are back. They can plausibly represent themselves as being plugged in to whoever it is that's actually running the United States government, because nobody knows who the hell is running the United States government. Nicola Timmerman says, from Francophone Ontario, Nicola Timmerman says, is there any way we can prove that climate change ideology is a religion and ergo the state should not be enshrining it as its official religion? Also, has anyone made an estimate how much this green religion has cost us to date? Again, that goes back to what I was saying about the difference between us and China. China doesn't go along with this. That Copenhagen conference about a decade ago, just after the whole climate gate broke, and it was all the usual crowd were there, Al Gore, the Prince of Wales, and the entire Western world had agreed to drive its economy off the cliff. And the only reason they didn't get away with it was because China didn't want to go along with it. So it actually, what saved us at Copenhagen were the communists. All the non-communists were crazy because they found something that's even kookier than communism. And so it took the Chi-Coms to save us from mass civilizational suicide at Copenhagen a decade or so back. Now fast forward a decade, and they figure out that, look, they've had people in lockdown for a year. They've had normal life suspended for a year, except for one or two places like Florida and Estonia. Other than that, life is very weird in most places, certainly when Nicola happens to live on some of these Canadian provinces have some of the most severe lockdowns in the Western world because Justin Trudeau hasn't a clue about what he's doing, and his cluelessness has been passed on to people who gave a reasonable performance of being passably sane, like the now ludicrous Doug Ford in Ontario. And the fact is, one of the things that, if you listen to my reading of 1984, one of the things that emerges in that is that totalitarianism, to be lasting, needs a rationale. And otherwise it becomes, you know, and you can have like a socioeconomic rationale of the kind that Marxists and Leninists had. And that's really not sufficient for the most part, which is why it went belly up in Russia and in Eastern Europe. But a rationale that, as Vincent Courtillot, the French scientist I quoted in my deposition by Mann's lawyer a couple of months back, as Monsieur Courtillot says, the genius thing about the hockey stick is it's not falsifiable. It's not falsifiable, which is why it's not science. Because if you can't disprove it, it's not a question of proving it. There's really nothing to prove. He set up a statistical model that basically, no matter what you throw in that statistical model, it produces a hockey stick. So it's not a proof of anything, and if it can't be proved, it can't be disproved. That's the beauty of the hockey stick as a scientific construction. And he says if it's not falsifiable, it's not science. They basically declared that there is no such thing as the medieval warm period and so forth. But the genius of the world we live in now. You know, we have a transcendent meaning for totalitarianism, which is that we're saving the planet. When will we have saved it? Okay, so we've all I threw away my washing machine and I got rid of the car. And now I beat my clothes dry on the rocks down by the river once a week. And I'm really excited about doing it because I really want to save the planet. God forbid we should fail to save the planet. Can you let us know, do you have an estimated date for when we'll have saved the planet and I might be able to go and get a washing machine? Oh, no. We all, and lockdown has actually been the perfect illustration of that. You know, it was 2 weeks to flatten the curve. So that's like saying, OK, we're going to have 2 years to save the planet. It's 2 weeks to flatten the curve. OK, well, it went a bit longer than that. It went 4-6 weeks and then the curve started flattening. And can we come out of lockdown now? Oh, no, because there's a second wave that's coming along. So we might have to have this time we'll just need a couple of months to flatten the curve. Okay, yeah, but after that, well, no. It looks like there might be a third wave. Well, the third wave didn't really do much. Oh, but we've now got the non-China virus. You can't say China virus, but you can say UK strain, South African variant. So we've now got the Azerbaijani strain of the East Timor variant coming in. So we might have to stay. You know, once people abase themselves before the transcendent meaning, and that's the great advantage, because saving the planet is, you know, it doesn't get any bigger than that. Lockdown has shown, though. Lockdown is basically we're dealing with a virus here. A virus isn't glamorous, and it's really, it makes almost every aspect of life unpleasant and difficult and all the rest of it. And what's striking is how even in America, the limited pushback against this government control, and that's, Nicola, you're quite correct to say that climate change is a state religion. Your idiot Conservative Party leader, not in Ontario, but at the federal level, Erin O'Toole, he says he's like a liberal on that. He's like Boris Johnson. The science is settled. You can't question it. So it's actually one of the few in bitter partisan split societies. Saving the planet, climate change, ruining life is one of the few things both sides, at least as represented by Erin O'Toole and Boris Johnson, agree on. And it is a state religion. Robert Fox says, what did you make of the quote-unquote news conference? I'm going to put that to one side, Robert, because as you know, I'm going to be talking about it with Tucker. Emily says, "Did you watch the Joe Biden press conference?" We can't be doing all these. We're going to have to do that with Tucker. Owen Morgan says, "Is there still such a thing as the free world? And if so, who is its leader now?" Well, I made that point at Michelle Buckman's tremendous conference on election integrity, which we've linked to at Stein Online, and which I hope you'll take a look at if you haven't already. And I think it was Kate Smythe who first made this point, that you can't be the leader of the free world if your country is no longer in the free world. And if you happen to think, as I do, that was not a legitimate election on November the 3rd, that there is, you know, people are, you know, I had some tiresome little twit from the Bulwark, you know, a nothing site run by Bill Kristol, the incredible shrinking man, who wound up voting for Joe Biden. So if you want to know who to blame for Joe Biden, blame Bill Kristol. It's as good as anybody. I basically gave the foreigner's point of view on America's filthy elections. And that's because I never feel as foreign as I do when I see the crap going on in America. And this guy, this snippy little dweeb, who gets paid $30 or whatever. Actually, he's probably got more money than that because Bill, that's one thing Bill does know how to do is fleece donors. But there's this snippy little guy saying, Stein is complaining because votes are being driven around and that means it enables fraud. Yeah, because as I said, in every country that runs a clean election, votes are counted with where they're cast. This is where I don't even get where Bill Kristol is on this anymore, because there's nothing in the crappy election system that the United States uses that the founding fathers would have entertained for a moment, because that's not anything like they had in mind. So get your head out of your parochial butt, you little Bill Kristol pajama boy, because, as I said, Denmark doesn't do it. I mean, whatever system you want to take. If you don't like the Westminster system, if you don't like the way they do it in Canada, the Bahamas, Belize, the United Kingdom, Ireland, Australia, Singapore, India, South Africa, whatever. If you don't like any of that, look at the Continentals. They don't do it like that in Denmark. They don't do it like that in France. They don't do it like that in Slovenia. You can look at parts of Africa. You can look at Asia. None of them run that system except the dictatorial basket cases, but no respectable country drives votes around. That in itself is a sign. That's all I did in that. That's all I did there. I just laid out all the features of the American system that enable fraud and pointed out that most countries don't have any of those features, and the United States is the only country with all of them. Sabre Mike Carroll says, since most of the questions will be dealing with the arrival of idiocracy roughly 480 years ahead of schedule, I would like to ask something that has nothing to do with the current state of the world, but the answer to which I would find quite interesting. Of all the columns or non-book pieces you have written over the years, which ones are your personal favourites where you look back and think, I nailed it with this one? Mine is Uneasy Lies the Crown from Head to Toe, because it was just so perfectly constructed and well done with the great setup to the big reveal. Well, I do. You can sort of tell which pieces I like because I wouldn't be sticking them between hard covers if I didn't think they had some value. Sometimes you can do things that are just, passing bits of flotsam and jetsam and do it rather well. I did some of those in the 2000 presidential election, for example, one about where Al Gore thanks his father. There were ones that I was always very pleased about. Al Gore, to launch his presidential campaign, he went back to the alleged farm he grew up in. He grew up in a hotel in Washington, in fact. But he rented, in order to make it look more convincing, he rented a herd of cows to stand behind him when he launched his presidential bid. I don't believe anybody has done that. And of course, that's low hanging fruit and it just drops into your lap. And so, I did. It started with. So when I said he'd rented a herd of cows, I said he got it from Herd's Rent-A-Cow or whatever. And and I just did cow jokes. And I can't remember. Do you want polled Herefords? I just want them to stand there. I don't need to know what they think. And I just did cow jokes for whatever it was, 800 words, 1,000 words. And it's a bit of a... Things like that are a... things like that afford a pleasure. A certain kind of pleasure. It's not unimportant because Al Gore, in theory, is going to be the next president of the United States. But it's a slightly preposterous thing to do because you're, you, as I said, you're just doing cow jokes. And, you know, he said his father taught him how to clear a steep hillside with whatever it was. And as I said, he didn't grow up on this farm. He grew up at this hotel at which various ambassadors and other people live. You know, so I talked about him clearing the palm court of whatever hotel it was. And something like that is just because it's an exercise. It's an exercise in the way that a crossword puzzle is an exercise, or some of our parody lyrics are exercises, because you sit down with a piece of paper and you think Al Gore cows, and you just like, let me see here now, herds rent a car, blah, 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 polled Herefords. You just do like 10 or 12 lame puns that you know you want to work in there, and then you think of how you can connect them up so they don't seem so obviously shoehorned in and labored. So it's got to be lightly worn, that kind of thing. And so often those things, they're things that aren't important. They're not things you necessarily want to put between hard covers, but they are satisfying. If you know, if your head's about to explode because you're thinking that France is tipping past the point of no return in its Islamic no-go areas, and China has got a bigger surface fleet than America, and is turning the Pacific into a Chinese lake in the way that the Indian Ocean was once a British lake. And if you think about these things too much, your head will explode. And so sometimes it's some of these ones that are the most satisfying at the time. Sometimes you say something that is profound, and you are pleasantly surprised when you dust it off and look at it 15, 20 years later. And sometimes you find yourself, as I did after going to a maternity shop in Vienna that I mentioned en passant, sometimes you realize you've stumbled on a big thesis, like America Alone. Colin Bastable writes, was Bojo mentally damaged by his run-in with the Wuhan flu? His bird, Carrie, seems to be carrying on as his Kamala, and he's agreeing to ever less conservative measures. The latest is vaccine passports to get into pubs, which he and his consorts and offspring will never need to flash. He's happier in Tuscany anyway, not down the pub buying rounds. It's going to take Wat Tyler on steroids to regain control of that land, that realm, that England. Boris is a man of no... I've talked about Boris before. He's a man of no fixed beliefs. He has no reliable political philosophy whatsoever. But what's interesting is I compared him favorably to people like, you know, Andrew Scheer in Canada. But what's really revealing is to see that he's actually just as pitiful as the most pitiful of conservative leaders in say Canada. Because actually, you know, Boris had two things going for him. He didn't want to be a flop. He genuinely thinks he's Churchill. And he's going to go down right now. He's going to go down as a failure who damaged his party. Now, maybe it won't be next week. It might not even be next election. But if this is Boris Johnson conservatism, he's at best a total irrelevance to history. So he's not going to be Churchill. He's not going to be Thatcher. He's going to be one of those people who just chunters along in the job between the great figures, and no one will remember him. And in particular, he's going to be remembered for inflicting great damage on the body politic through the massive expansion of powers. Now, I actually think he has got long coat. I think Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour Party leader, I think Sir Keir accused Mr Johnson of having long COVID. This is where the after effects linger. And I think to a certain extent he was actually damaged by that. And I think he remembers what happened to him. And I think that's one of the reasons why the UK never quite comes out of lockdown. But if he is serious, he's been comparing himself to Churchill for 20 years. And if he's serious about it, he's actually, at some point, he's got to knock it off with this. I mean, for a start, Churchill wouldn't be shacked up with Carrie Symons without benefit of clergy in number 10. This is really the Peter Hitchens thesis, and I should give him credit for it. But Peter is not right when, you know, you pay no attention to what the guy says, but you look at what he does, how he lives his life. There's nothing conservative about the way Boris Johnson lives his life. And that counts for more than whatever it is he says. Now, he's the they used to call Harold Macmillan the actor manager of British politics. I don't know whether, which is a reference to 19th century repertory companies. Boris has got the acting down part. He can't do the managing. The acting of this Woodhousian bluffer, which he isn't. He's a whatever he is. He's a half Turkish immigrant who basically has invented a centuries-old, deep-in-the-soil-of-England persona that would make you think he'd grown up at the ancestral manor house that's been in the family for 700 years or whatever. He perfected an act. So he's of the Harold Macmillan actor-manager bit. He's got the actor part down. He can't do the managing. The play is crap. And so seeing a Woodhousian bluffer who appears to have the mien of a Tory prime minister, but is in fact just mired in a third-rate, utterly third-rate, undistinguished ministry regurgitating 80% of the tired, clapped-out social justice platitudes of a left-of-centre party is truly pathetic. Ian Chandler writes, Jim Swift's bulwark. I think this is Jim Swift was the little pyjama boy who was mocking Michelle's conference on election integrity, and indeed mocking me. Jim Swift's bulwark is perhaps mainly around the truth, says Ian Chandler, in the sense of stopping people's access to it rather than protecting it from manipulation. He sneers at those interested in election integrity and brushes aside perfectly valid criticisms and concerns which he would share if made on behalf of the Democrats and President Trump. This underlines the mindset of the left. Normal rules of engagement don't apply. How can conservatives or anyone motivated by getting to the truth counteract the attitudes and actions of a set of people who are so morally bankrupt? Well, I think you have to shove their moral bankruptcy down their throats. I don't think we're hard enough, for example, on Biden over what's going on at the border. Biden is basically enriching the drug cartels and the human trafficking cartels. So he's basically the coyote in chief right now. Because nobody gets across that border unless they go through the cartels. It's like the seaports in Libya, which have all fallen into the hands of ISIS or its affiliates. So, you know, we're all nice about the refugees. But in fact, the refugee tide is enriching ISIS and the like. Likewise, the human trafficking on the Rio Grande is enriching the cartels and the human traffickers. So the most evil people in the Americas, the people bringing in the fentanyl to kill Americans, The people bringing 12-year-old girls into the United States and forcing them to work as prostitutes to repay them. These are the people Joe Biden is enriching. There's nothing nice about being a liberal progressive. You're on the side of evil. You'd kill yourself if you'd somehow managed to do that to your own daughter. You'd be so ashamed of your moral decrepitude if you'd done that to your own daughter. If you've got a 12-year-old daughter and you'd somehow put her into the hands of these people south of the border so she's working as a child prostitute to pay back the people who smuggled her across the Rio Grande. So you wouldn't do that to your own daughter, but you're happy to do it to all the daughters of Latin America. You are morally bankrupt. This is moral bankruptcy. And this is what happens. This is why there's not a lot of easy ways about that, back from this, because this is what big remote government tends to do. You wouldn't do it if it was in your own, if you lived in, as I do, if you lived in a small town of a few hundred people, the liberal progressive woman wouldn't be able to do this to a group of 12-year-old girls in that town, because it's in your face and you see it. And that's why big government is bad, because the minute it gets big and remote and you're talking in abstractions and generalities about people who are beyond the horizon and out of sight, it's easy to screw people over. It's easy to not make the connection between the fentanyl that's killing people in New Hampshire and what's going on at the southern border. It's easy not to make the connection about people getting macheted to death in suburban Long Island and what's going on at the southern border. It's easy not to make the connection between some girl getting raped by illegal immigrants in a Virginia school and what's going on at the southern border. And that's why you should shove it down these people's throats. There's nothing good or moral about this. It's an act of charity. It's basically like the Clinton Foundation. It's a phony charity that does nothing for the supposed beneficiaries of the charity, whose lives are as crap or crapper as they ever were, but it bigs up the supposed charitable donors. Liberalism is basically, contemporary liberalism is basically just the Clinton Foundation writ large. Absolutely revolting. Eric Dale says, "Hey, Mark, I read through the Execrable Bulwark article you linked today reviewing yesterday's symposium regarding voter fraud and glanced at the headlines of the other writers there. It seems to me that we conservatives are doomed to lose, as there is always a self-sabotage caucus such as the Lincoln Project or the Bulwark writers or lately the Chamber of Commerce that puts on the brakes whenever we have a majority in office and never seems overly concerned about the left when we're in the minority. This HR1, it seems to me, is truly an existential threat to the political balance of this country. Just as California was once a right-leaning swing state, only to become an authoritarian one-party state. If this bill becomes law, it's hard to see how Republicans or any party other than the Democrats will elect a president of their choosing again. When and where do the squishes and unaffiliated voters wake up and stand up to one-party rule?" Well, you know, when you look at people like the Lincoln Project was just a grifter racket for people who cover up for a sexual predator, aside from anything else. Well, they all knew what he was getting up to since the 1980s. But also that's the racket of American politics. Jeb, yeah, I really think you've got a lot to offer the country. You would make a great president. Why don't you hire me as your consultant? Oh, yeah, okay, that's good. So you're going to raise $100 million. Yeah, I'll raise $100 million and I'll blow it on useless, generic, insert name of candidate here ads that nobody pays any attention to. And if we've still got anything left over, we're going to have a giant cookout and I'm going to have a big bonfire and we'll throw the remaining $30 million on that. And it's a racket that has nothing to do. You know, when you look at one... let's put it this way. That kind of grifter conservatism, which is, you know, to be honest, an awful lot of the quote-unquote movement. Grifter conservatism is never going to do anything for real conservatism. It can go through the motions. You know, it can go through the motions with its tedious attack ads and all the rest of it. But they're not serious people. And Trump was a threat to their racket. And their racket is a loser's racket. Oh, what have you done? Well, I ran the Bob Dole campaign. Oh, did you really? Oh, and I also ran the Mitt Romney campaign. Oh, I say, that's really impressive. That's a game for losers. Then you have the Chamber of Commerce, right? For example, I don't dig the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers are not conservative. The Koch brothers are libertarians, and libertarians generally believe in open borders. So we have this lunatic thing where the so-called moderate right, the respectable right, believe in two things. They believe in mass low-skilled immigration, and at the same time, they believe in exporting all the jobs. So in other words, the factory that your dad worked at is now in China, and your kids can't get a job at that factory, but nevertheless, they have to compete for the night shift at Taco Bell with all these unskilled immigrants from Latin America. My big problem with Trump is that Trump was elected on an urgency platform. We needed a Trump-sized figure to do things quickly. Because if we don't reverse this quickly, it's not just that we have to change, we have to change quickly. And Trump, as Trump discovered, he was in the situation where he had to battle not only the nominal official opposition, but he had to battle three quarters of his own party. And whether or not Trump runs again in 2024, nobody knows. And, you know, and if HR1 goes through, there's no point running because there's never going to be a Republican president again. But what we need is someone who is going to be able to take it to the opposition at speed so that things can change with speed. And people like Bulwark, I mean, I just link to that thing because I generally think it's sporting just to link to the guy who's pissing all over you because he doesn't have many readers and you might as well toss him a bone. But these people aren't important. What's important? They're only important because if you get your news from NPR, PBS, Meet the Press, those kinds of things, the spirited partisan debate is usually between a genuine figure of the left and a phony figure of the right, a castrated figure of the right. Jim Swift would probably do a great job on PBS or NPR. Left Coaster Claudia writes, Mark, your understanding of the issues as well as your command of voice and language is always appreciated. You would be surprised, Claudia, how many people don't like my voice and language. Your announcers are excellent as well. You've mentioned Andrew, but not the woman whose voice we hear. I especially appreciate that she does not overproject in the way many female announcers do, seemingly to sound more authoritative. Or is that masculine? They are both appreciated, as are you. Best regards, Claudia. Well, a lot of people like our female announcer. Tim Rice, you know, who turns up here from time to time. He often has an interesting observation on our songs of the week. And I think we had him on our audio show talking about One Night in Bangkok, which is one of his songs, along with the songs from The Lion King and Jesus Christ Superstar and Evita. and all the rest. But Tim actually appreciates her voice, the voice of our mysterious female announcer too. So you're not alone there, Claudia. I'll pass that along to her. Chris Hall writes, Mark, since you are the grand Kliegel of free speech, I wonder if you could comment on the general approach that many are taking with respect to censorship by the big boys on social media like Dorsey and Zuckerberg. I very much enjoyed the Election Integrity Conference and noticed that Regent U was using its own, or at least non-YouTube, video server. You've also stepped up to the plate and helped get out Mark Morano's book. It seems like people are using the classic method of minimizing damage from incoming artillery fire by dispersing as widely as possible. This could be the opposite of a denial of service attack, where instead of funneling through narrow choke points, people set up millions of micro servers that continually move around in the internet. This is the same manner as frequency agility, as first described by that awesome engineer and Hollywood star, Hedy Lamarr. I had to get a cinema hook in there somewhere. God bless Hedy Lamarr. What a fabulous actress and a very smart lady too. Maybe we'll do a little bit on Hedy Lamarr in our movie column somewhere. And I think that's actually, you don't need to create a YouTube. You could have, and it would actually be better if they, instead of, because then, you know, you'd be in a, it'd be like the Republicans and the Democrats and blue states and red states. It'd be better to have YouTube and 1,047 alternatives to YouTube, in the way that if you think about restaurants, you know, there are people who like eating at Applebee's or 99's. But generally speaking, if you want to take the missus out for a special occasion, you don't say to her, I thought we'd go to Burger King. You generally look for something that isn't a chain restaurant. And as you know, those places can do very well, and they often invariably charge more than the fast food joints. So it can actually... that can actually be as effective as... I mean, that's true if you go to places that are renowned. If you go to some town in Italy, it'll be ranked highly in terms of restaurants, because it'll have 47 restaurants, and it might have some chain place out in the strip mall on the road out of town on the way to the airport or whatever. But in other words, if you have a healthy boutique culture collectively, that can eventually outpace the one-size-cookie-fits-all YouTube-type model. And that's all I say we do there. I don't actually approve of the... I read, for example, and I don't want to keep talking about Parler, except I do think it was interesting that I was getting all this rubbish from people. Oh, why are you still on Twitter, Stein? I always knew you were a cuckservative. You weren't the real thing. You're just a little bitch boy for Zuckerberg and the weird beard. Why don't you be a man? Why don't you man up and move to Parler? And I never liked the sound of Parler because when I mentioned this before, when you looked at the terms... not the rules of engagement, whatever they're called, the terms of service. That's it, not rules of engagement. It's like they weren't any... They sounded familiar to me. And by familiar, I mean they sounded like Carrie Katz's terms of service for CRTV and Blaze. And what do you know, the thing's headquartered in Nevada. And as I said, I know Rebecca Mercer, who's the big honcho at Parler. Good luck to her. She's got a lot of money and she can spend it how she wants. But I've just been reading this fascinating court filing, actually a very well-written one, by the CEO of Parler, who was on TV with Tucker as the great crusader for free speech. And then Parler decided to fire him. I think it was Dan Bongino and... Rebecca Mercer and whoever decided to fire him, and he's now suing them. And I must say, reading it, a lot of the things that are going on sounded awfully familiar from the Carrie cats and CRTV suits. And I don't actually think there's much point to sugar daddy conservatism. I'm past that in part because of, you know, various aspects of it are not appealing to me. And I do think, in fact, if you look at, for example, I happen to know who the people who do the videos for Regent University, and it is quite good. It's quite a reasonable service. Yes, it's not YouTube. It doesn't have the reach of YouTube, but on the other hand, it doesn't come with all the problems of YouTube. And I think there's a lot to be said for just everybody. I think that's a really important point, Chris. You don't need to wait for a billionaire to say, I'm going to be the next Zuckerberg, but I'm going to be a right-wing Zuckerberg. Because, you know something? It's unfortunately a feature of corporate life in America that once you're at that level, they somehow manage to be able to turn you. Like they turned the Chick-fil-A guys. And I'd just as soon let 1,001 flowers bloom. Let's see what we got for the... Wait a minute. For a last question here that isn't something on all this depressing politics. Oh, this is quite an interesting one. David says, Hi, Mark. I was thinking this Stein Club thing has been quite unpredictable. For a while, it was Stein posts and interviews, then Tales for Our Time, and lately the audio shows through the plague. And the mystery continues. I've been wondering why, other than personal interest, you were meeting with victims of the grooming gangs across England, expecting a book or some form of content on the subject, but nothing. Fortunately, I enjoy it all. But I was thinking it would be great to learn what your plans are for the club. I do enjoy your long-form discussions with fascinating figures. Glitches with Zoom is not a good enough reason to give them up. I would also love some club member participation. Maybe we could vote on what next or possible guests. So come on, Stein. Why so coy? What do you have in mind for the next 5 years? Best wishes, David. You're not actually quite right about that, David. Tales of Our Time, for example, which you seem to think was some sort of second phase of the Mark Stein Club, I actually believe we started that in the first month. If not in the first month, then in the next 6 weeks, because I was a bit unsure what to do, and we put it up and sort of as one of these Democrats said. Of the border crisis, we're basically building the plane en route. Well, we actually did build the plane on the Mark Stein Club once we'd take it off. And so in those first couple of weeks, we were just thinking, well, what can we do? And then we decided to do Tales for Our Time, the tragedy of the Carrasco. But if you look that up, I think you'll find that was definitely in the first 4 or 6 weeks of the club. So it goes right back to the beginning. And the Sunday poetry didn't come along, for example, much long after that. So a lot of these features we've had now for getting on for 4 years. And I do like to freshen things up a bit, even on the audio versions of the show. You know, the 100 Years Ago show didn't quite start on our very first show. It came along, I think, about 6 weeks, 2 months later, whatever it was. So we try to come, you know, rather than just doing the same old stuff, we do try to come up with new ideas. And I'm not being coy about it, but we like to have a certain amount of text, and we like to have a certain amount of audio, and we like to have a certain amount of video. And then we have things which we're asked to do. So, for example, I found myself in the latter half of the last 6 months or so, guest hosting Rush far more than I normally would have under any scenario, because poor old Rush was so ill. So we cut back on the frequency of the Mark Stein shows, and in part because if you're doing 3 days of Rush, you don't necessarily then want two more audio shows in the course of 5 days. And likewise, you know, if I'm doing a week of hosting on Fox News Primetime, that's their 7 p.m. Eastern Time show, if I'm doing that, or if I'm guest hosting on Tucker, that provides a certain amount of video content, and you then want to offer some text and audio alternatives and all the rest of it. Now then, and again, I'm not being coy about that. If you keep that principle in mind, you'll understand why we do what we do. And then you say, why am I meeting with victims of the grooming gangs across England, expecting a book or some form of content on the subject, but nothing? Well, it's been a long time since I wrote a book, and the short answer for that is because Carrie Katz stole several years of my life, the bastard. And so I had a thing, until the COVID, though, there's nothing unusual about this. I've made it a point over many years now of when I'm in Sweden, I always go to Malmo and Rosengard, see what's going on there. I like when I'm in France, when I'm in Belgium, if there's one of those, or Germany, one of those kind of stories are in the news, I always like to seek out the people who participated in them. So I talked to some of the women who were sexually assaulted in Toulouse on New Year's Eve a couple of years back. I was in France and sought out a woman and her daughters who'd been attacked by, they were at a holiday cottage, and the person in the middle of nowhere. And the person at the next cottage was one of the excitable Mohammedans, and they were both sitting out on the terrace having breakfast, and he objects to the way the little girls are in their swimsuits, and he goes bananas and starts stabbing them with a knife. And it's one of those beautiful French mountain villages, les villages perchés, the perching villages. And so you can't even get an ambulance up there easily, so they have to get a helicopter from Grenoble that comes in, lands, and takes them away. So I sought out the background to that story if I happened to be in the neighbourhood. And I did I haven't actually used a lot of that much, although you've had glimpses of it hither and yon, because Carrie Katz stole a couple of years of my life. And so whatever book I might have had in mind, I didn't get to write. And I've done other things instead, and I hope you've enjoyed them. But we try to keep a variety here. We try to introduce new features. We try to freshen up the old features. You'll notice that certain regular features come and go on the Mark Stein Show. You'll notice that we modify the way we do some of our poetry, but it also is to do with the fact that, I mean, for example, you talked about the Stein posts, which are basically monologues. And I felt, for example, that if I'm doing monologues every night on Fox News primetime, or when I'm guest hosting for Tucker, or when I'm guest hosting, as I was, for Rush, that they were basically duplicating the kinds of things I was doing on 600 radio stations and on America's number one cable show. So we try not to have duplication, and we try to keep it all balanced. And as to what do I have in mind for the next 5 years? Well, as Joe Biden just said, I don't look 3.5 years ahead. I do look 3.5 years ahead, and I get mighty scared about some things. But thank you for that question, David. And David's final point, if you've got a suggestion for the Mark Stein Club, if you think there's something we're not doing that you'd like us to do, you are always welcome to shoot us a suggestion about that. But we try to kind of keep a balance between the audio and print pieces, and then what I'm doing on television, so that we've got a variety of media that we do here each week. And that's our guide on that. Thank you very much for that question, David. Thank you for all your questions today. And sorry if it's been a bit of a technical mishmash, but we do hope that Joe, our longtime audio engineer on these shows, will get better soon, and that he will be he'll be fully recovered and back behind the glass for us, because that is what is most important. But that is it for us, and we will see you next time. Stay safe, stay free.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.